All right. Well, as our slide shows here, we have our series title slide that I'm using. I'd love to say that I was able to design this slide myself, that I actually had that kind of graphic arts ability. But the closest thing I would have to that is making little stick figures showing the characters in the Bible. But I kind of like it because it's from beginning to end. There's Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, you know, kind of in shame, having to leave the garden because of their sin. Going all the way through to the end here, just thoughts on, Christ and the revelation and so forth, the end times and so forth. So, anyways, and kind of just different scenes that are in between the two. But we're going to continue in our series. So you see by the title slide that we're in a 40-point overview of the Bible. And today we're on point number 26. So we've actually covered quite a few points so far. Time flies by when you're having fun. So point number 26, Babylon captures Judah in three waves. So let's go to our next slide here. We have several slides in a row that will just be by way of review. Kind of get our brains in gear, get the thinking juices flowing. This one I put up last lesson, mainly for the idea of just kind of looking and seeing that, and I know parts of this are a little hard to read from where you're sitting, but this is the Bible bookcase. So the books of the Bible and how we tend to organize them, the first five books of the Law of Moses, or the Pentateuch, as it's sometimes called, books of history, and we'll be in 2 Kings a decent amount today as it reveals the history of Judah at the time of the Babylonian takeover. And a lot of this is Jewish history, but mixed in with the Jewish history are prophets. Even though we have down here prophets, the major prophets and the minor prophets, there are prophets ministering while these things are going on. Elijah, for example, during the time of King Ahab, okay, Elisha after him. So, of course, you have the books of poetry and stuff. But anyways, a lot of the minor and major prophets were men of God who were given a prophetic ministry to proclaim, and that's what prophetic ministry is, proclaiming what God wants you to proclaim, whether it's future or not. It's both in many cases. And the prophets had messages to Judah, which were messages, in many ways, of reminders of what they should have already known. Because the law of Moses, here in Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, parts of Exodus, like Exodus chapter 20, for example, that has the Ten Commandments, they already knew and should have known what they were supposed to be doing. The word of God had been given to the nation of Israel. They had less excuse than most nations. In fact, all nations. Because they were given the words of God. And they had more direct revelation in that sense. So the Jews knew what they were supposed to be doing. And God did more than that. He not only told them what they're supposed to be doing, but he said, here's what's going to happen if you do, and here's what's going to happen if you don't. And if they did not obey God, they entered into this covenant relationship with God, which is what the Old Testament refers to, the name Old Testament. It's the Old Covenant. So this old agreement. And they entered into this old agreement, this old covenant with God, where God would do things for Israel, but Israel had obligations themselves in that agreement. And a big part of that is spelled out in the first of the Ten Commandments. They're not supposed to have any other gods that come before God. They don't put other gods before them. And that was one of the big problems, was the idolatry, as we'll be reminded of in a slide here in a little bit. But anyways, in looking at these points that we're at right now, they're really almost probably two-thirds of the Old Testament touches on this time period. Because we're doing an overview, so we're covering hundreds and hundreds of years in the short time period. Well, let's go to our next slide then. This reminds us, again, this is all review from past lesson. This just reminds us, as we in the past lesson took a look at Isaiah chapter 5 as a representative chapter on the types of things that Israel and Judah were condemned for. And Isaiah was ministering specifically to the two southern tribes that we call Judah, the nation of Judah. But the message Isaiah had was the same as the messages that prophets were giving to the northern ten tribes. And they're summarized on this slide here. And we won't go through all the verses again on this. But here's kind of the summary of it. That there were those who were trying to accumulate land to themselves and often oppressing their neighbors. Remember, the concept of Israel was that every family had an inheritance. Okay, so every tribe had family clans, and then within that clan, they had an inheritance that the members of that family, you know, would expect to have. And so some greedy landlords were finding ways to, you know, basically take another man's inheritance. And, we saw that maybe a little bit in our country 10 plus years ago when the housing bubble burst, that we started to find out that there were those that were making loans where the loan wasn't a good idea. And, there's a certain accountability that the people themselves had. I mean, you know, you should make sure you know what you're getting into. But the finance people understood the finances more than some of the people that were getting the loan. So I think some people didn't really completely understand what they were getting into. But the finance people knew the risk and didn't always share that. So then we came out with this, you know, name for them. We call them predatory lenders. Well, Israel had predatory lenders, found ways to swindle people out of their property. There were some that were focused on pleasures, just partying in life, but partying in a way that did not honor God. Then there were those that made crime really almost like a profession. And so then there were those that really focused on, you know, pride. These two, humanist and conceited philosopher, are two verses that just express how mankind was really focused on himself. Verse 20, woe to them that call evil good and good evil. They become the definite, they become for defining what's right and wrong. That's verse 20. And then verse 21, woe to those that are wise in their own eyes. Okay, so they just have this real high opinion of their own abilities. And then we have the last one there. Those that were in a position of leadership, exercising their authority very poorly. Judges who would take bribes and would allow them to be influenced. You know, it's more like alcohol. That's part of it. They allowed themselves for their judgment to be impaired. They also allowed it to be impaired through things like bribery. And so this was a lot of the common behavior in the Jewish society at this time. And God had warned against this, that they should have, these judges should have judged in integrity and in truth, but they were not doing so. Okay? And so then,
none of those changed over time.
No, well, they're common human problems. If a person is not Holy Spirit led, then they're being led by something else. Yeah, we have these things have always persisted. The thing about the Jewish society is these were the norm, as opposed to the exception. I think every society has someone that's doing these things, but does the society as a whole embrace this? Each society embraces this, you know, maybe to differing extents. So we know that there's some countries that are known for corruption, but the United States has corruption. Question is, will the citizens of our country embrace that and accept it? Sometimes people embrace it because they actually are profiting. So, you know, that's where, you know, politicians maybe can get away with things because in the process they're also giving the citizens things. So as long as the citizens are happy and they're getting stuff out of the deal, then maybe the politician can do things that maybe they wouldn't be able to do otherwise. Okay, we'll go to our next slide. Still a slide of review here. Just some other things. Well, really, social abuse, the last one here, is, I mean, many of those other things were social abuses. I suppose it's redundant there. But Micah chapters 2 and 3 talks a little bit about some of those social abuses. I'll just glance at those if I have them here. Do I have them here? I couldn't remember if I printed them off this week. And oh, I know. Okay. Yep. I don't see that I have the Micah passages handy. Oh, I know. I'm looking at the wrong pile. That's the discard pile. I need to look at the new pile. I'm like, I can't find it. Well, then I realize, well, those are the ones I've already done. Okay, yeah. Yeah. Micah chapter 2, verse 1, the sexual abuses, it's warning those or saying woe to those that devise iniquity. Okay, they're just devising, coming up with evil plans. And they practice it. Why? It's in the power of their hand to do it. They have the ability to do it. They do it. Okay, and they covet fields and they take them by violence. Man in his house, even a man in his heritage, and that's kind of what the greedy landlords are doing. So men like that. So this was the consistent message over and over again. But then later in chapter 3 of Micah, prophets that make my people err, E-R-R, be an error. Religious leaders that should be helping the people grow spiritually instead are leading them into perhaps doctrinal error. Doctrine just means teaching. Leading them into doctrinal error. Leading them into wrong behavior, wrong actions. And this was common. Now, many of the religious leaders led the people into idolatry. Did not teach them in the things of the Bible. We'll see that in a little bit when we get to Josiah, King Josiah. The ignorance on the part of the priests of the Bible. They didn't even know what was in it, because they weren't teaching the Bible, they were teaching other things. Things had gotten really bad. Or some other things going on. The princes, as Micah 3:9 calls them, meaning the political leadership, what do? They abhor judgment, pervert all equity. In other words, they're treating people unfairly, not being just in their judgments. It says they judge for reward, so they're taking bribes. They teach for hire. They're doing things for money, for their own financial benefit. They divine for money. Divination or divining, as in prophesying or helping people, know the will of the Lord. But their motivation, money. So this is the condition of Israel and Judah. Now God had warned that if Israel went down this road, they would be punished for this. And God had been very, very specific about that. Okay, so let's. Last time we took a look at a timeline here, and this was a timeline that showed the end of Israel in the year 722 BC. Well, I'm going to do an expanded view of this timeline and just kind of get our brains going in gear to kind of process how to read this timeline. So I just stylized it a little bit different this week. So let's go to our next slide that says Judah right in the middle. The top timeline that's highlighted, that's Judah. Okay, now if I click again and go to Israel, this is Israel's timeline. Now notice the end of Israel's timeline. I know it's really small there. That says 722. But if you go to the end of Judah's timeline, it says 586. And those are the two years in B.C. where Israel and Judah ceased to exist. Israel was conquered by Assyria, and then Judah was conquered by Babylon. Okay, let's click again and show the other timelines that exist on there. The next one is Syria. Now, that's just a little timeline there. Actually, Syria and the northern kingdom of Israel fall at the same time to Assyria. Don't mix up Syria with Assyria. Okay, Syria is still a country that exists today, and we've heard about that in the news the last 10-15 years with all the chaos in Syria because their leader Assad, am I getting that name right? I think his name was Assad, was abusing his own people, and they were at a civil war in the country of Syria. No way, Syria, which is just to the north of Israel. And now that's become a breeding ground for terrorism. The country of Syria is still here, and the land area is the same land area. So Syria, the country just to the north of Israel, fell to Assyria. Now, Assyria is more in the modern-day area of Iran. And its capital city of Nineveh is, let's see if it's on this timeline. Yeah, you can see at the end of, now let's go to the next slide. This timeline is Assyria, and its capital city, Nineveh, which is written right here, but I'm sure not able to be read from where you're sitting. Maybe. Depends on whether you have eagle eyes or not. But Nineveh fell to the kingdom of Babylon. And so Assyria was one of the dominant powers on the earth when the northern tribes fell to them. Okay, so Assyria is to the east of Israel, Syria is to the north. All right, then we go here. Okay, and Babylon is the nation that will conquer Assyria and take over it and become the replacement dominant power. And then the final timeline, Egypt, the next slide, is the bottom one there. And we'll hear a lot about this name here, Necho. That'll come up in today's discussion. Okay, so now if we look at these slides, all the way on the left side, we talked last Sunday school class about the fall of the 10 tribes of Israel. God took them out first. Now, we've got to remember that this isn't the plan of God. Now, from a secular perspective, there's other things going on that are the causes for the fall of Israel. It wasn't that Assyria had in its mind, we want to fulfill the will of God and help God punish Israel. Assyria wasn't thinking that. Assyria had its own human agenda. Okay? But God, though, was using Assyria to do what he said he would. Now, the northern 10 tribes had done more wickedness than the southern 2 tribes, and none of their kings had honored God. So God took them out first and punished them first. But he allowed Judah to continue. But Judah itself did a lot of the same wickedness, so eventually he takes out Judah. So what we're going to do on our next slide, as we go to one of the first kings here, we'll start with Josiah. On the left side here, I focused on the right side of that timeline. Okay, so what we're zeroing in on the top here is Judah. And then we can see how that overlaps Assyria, kind of the end of Assyria leading into Babylon, and then Egypt down at the bottom, and how those kind of all go together. All right, so flip the page here. Make that 2. All right, now a lot of our passages here are going to come, as I said, from the book of 2 Kings. If you want to follow along, we'll be in 2 Kings chapter, starting in chapter 22, and going from there. We'll look at different passages as we become familiar with what was taking place during these times. Now, along the way, and we're not taking a lot of time for application today, but along the way, there's application. And a major one today is could be summarized by a verse. I forget the location of the verse of the Bible, but here's what the verse says. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. Okay, so people don't sin and get away with it. It doesn't matter if they look like they're getting away with it. No one gets away with sin. It does not work that way. Okay, and God reveals what was done in secret. And people suffer the consequences of their own sin, even when they think they don't. Okay, and that's one of the things that God teaches us in the scripture. Okay, well, during the time period of Josiah, before I get into Josiah, I meant to read this other handout here. So this will wrap up Israel, the 10 northern tribes that God took down with a final defeat in the year 722 BC. Here's just a little bit about that that comes from one article that I thought was interesting because it reveals a little bit of how their foreign adversary viewed them. So sometimes, again, I think we're tempted to view things from just a human secular standpoint and forget that God's behind these things. And God honors those that honor him, and he curses those that curse him. So let me just read a little bit here. The kingdom of Israel was known to the Assyrians after its founder, Bet-Humri, or translation, House of Omri, which we talked about, that wicked king in Israel. So to the Assyrians, that's what they called Israel. They didn't call it Israel. They called it House of Omri. Together with the kingdoms of Hamari and Damascus, it dominated the political landscape of the Syro-Palestine. Okay, Syro meaning Syria to the north, and Palestine meaning Israel area. Okay, and so in the 9th and 8th centuries BC, and like them, it eventually fell victim to the Assyrian expansion to the Mediterranean. Okay, so Israel controlled the Mediterranean ports to the south of the Lebanon Range, the Lebanon Mountain Range, and so forth, and the rich agricultural lands between the coast and the River Jordan, a strategically and economically profitable position which provided a link between the route networks across the sea and the desert. So it was a major trading area, and a lot of land trade routes went through Israel, and they were in a prime location. Well, that gets a little scary, right? You're in a prime spot. You've got things others might want. Others that are stronger than you might want to come in and take advantage of that. And that's kind of what goes on from Assyria's perspective. Israel's relations with Syria oscillated between neutral, cordial, and hostile. Excuse me. The submission of King Jehu is prominently depicted on one of the central panels of the so-called Black Obelisk, highlighting the importance of this alliance to Assyria. Okay, and then they go on to talk a little bit more about that kind of relationship. Let me skip down. Israel was directly affected when Assyria's western frontier was moved from the Euphrates to the Mediterranean coast and the Lebanon mountain range. The year 732 BC saw the first Assyrian invasion of Israel. This event is well documented in the Bible, albeit not from the viewpoint of Israel, but of its southern neighbor, the kingdom of Judah. It is possible to juxtapose this narrative with passages in the royal inscriptions of Tiglath-Pileser III, which, although fragmentary, provides valuable insight into the Assyrian view on the matter. The biblical account of the invasion of 732 BC differs from the Assyrian sources, above all, in the motivation. Now, it's not saying that the Bible's wrong, it's saying this. In the Bible, you're hearing God's perspective on what's going on. In the Assyrian accounts, you're hearing what the Assyrians are saying, why they're doing what they're doing, and what they believe is going on. So you get this, you know, different perspective, different take. Well, again, reading on, differs on the motivation identified as the driving Assyrian attack and conquest. According to the Bible, invaders were brought to Israel by Ahaz, king of Judah, who asked Tiglath-Pileser, that's the Assyrian king, for a military intervention against Israel and Damascus. So the king of Judah asked Assyria, help us, because they were at conflict with the northern tribes and Syria. So they asked a foreign foreign country to come help us out. And I'll summarize here. Assyria and Judah were kind of in a lord-vassal relationship at that point. In other words, they were Assyria was kind of under a treaty obligation to defend Judah because they were in a treaty with them, and were in a under an obligation to protect Judah at Judah's request. Okay? And so then it says below, from a Judean perspective, the Assyrian invasion of Israel was the direct consequence of their vassal treaty. Okay. So going down further, from an Assyrian perspective, however, the invasion of Israel was part of a much wider military offensive designed to establish political and economic dominance over the routes across the Syrian desert to the harbors of the Mediterranean. Okay. And I think I'll go ahead and leave it at that. So as we have today, there's a lot of geopolitical things going on, and things have not changed. And so basically, Israel and Judah didn't always want to submit to Assyria, and Assyria, though, wanted access to the trade routes and the ports and so forth, and Assyria had more military might, and so they came in and at Judah's request to help them, because they were under attack, and eventually then the 10 northern tribes are conquered. Okay, now that was in 722 BC. Now fast forward, God gives Judah more time. So what goes on in this time period? Well, we'll start with Josiah. Again, this is the Judah timeline up here. And here's some things that we see going on. One is that Nabopolassar comes to power. He's the Babylonian king. So we would read them, should you be able to read the name Nabopolassar. It's right there. Father of Nebuchadnezzar, we're more familiar with in the Bible. But he's the king, the power that helps basically take Assyria and conquer it and be replaced by him. So, by the way, just a little side note, some of the accuracy of the scripture referring to Nebuchadnezzar. Allowed and king, even as his dad was still king, and so you had a co-regent between Nabopolassar's son. Okay, so Nabopolassar comes to power in Babylon in the year 626 BC. In the year 622 BC, the Book of the Law is discovered. We'll read a little bit about that. I'll just kind of fly through these points, and then you can reference them as we're reading. The fall of Nineveh happened in 612 BC, so Assyria is no longer. And then Josiah himself is killed in the year 609 BC. But let's read a little bit about Josiah. The last good king in the eyes of God that reigned in this area. Oops, I'm going from the wrong pile again. Let me, now that I read that other one, let me reduce down to two piles, and that'll prevent me from doing that. Okay. So, here's what God says, 2 Kings chapter 22, verse 1, Josiah was 8 years old when he began to reign. Now, that means he would have had an adult that would kind of run things on his behalf until he was old enough to reign himself. He reigned 31 years in Jerusalem, verse 2, he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, and walked in all the ways of David his father. He turned not aside to the right hand or to the left. Okay. Well, this part of this began, and we read further down in verse 8, through some series of events, we see it illustrated, that is, Josiah's obedience to God illustrated. In verse 8, Josiah had instructed repairs of the temple in verses 3 through 7, and in the process of the temple being rebuilt, Hilkiah, the high priest, finds something in the temple. You ever find something you forgot you had? Well, Hilkiah found something that they forgot they had. Verse 8, I have found the book of the law in the house of the Lord. So that's an example. The religious leadership, they weren't reading the Bible. I don't know what they were doing, but they weren't reading the Bible. He's like, wow, hey, look at this. Here's a copy of the Bible, the law of Moses. And he read it. And then a man named Shaphan, who was a scribe, he brought that to the king, and then the king had that read to him. And then verse 22, and it came to it's chapter 20, verse 11, and it came to pass when the king had heard the words of the book of the law that he rent or tore his clothes. Okay, that's you know, was their Eastern way of just showing like, whoa, what you're like, like I'm. Grief, sorrow, and taking this seriously. And verse 12, King commanded, verse 13, go inquire of the Lord for me. You know, they didn't have the full revelation of God. It was a common practice then, go to someone who was a prophet of God. Or in this case, they're actually going to go, verse 14, to a prophetess. Okay. And we've read about several prophetesses in the Bible. Deborah was one of them during the time of the Judges. they go to a prophetess named Huldah, and they talk with her. In verse 15, she tells them, here's what God says. So God has given her a revelation, a message to Josiah, who is inquiring of God, what should we do? And so here's her message, verse 15. Tell the man that sent you to me, in other words, tell King Josiah, thus saith the Lord, verse 16, behold, I will bring evil upon this place and upon the inhabitants thereof, speaking of Judah, even all the words of the book which the king of Judah hath read. You know, that's what, one of the things that really moved Josiah. He read in the Bible and realized we're sinning big time, and God has told us he's going to judge us for it. And he's like, oh man, we're in big trouble. Rent his clothes and let's choir of God and find out what we should do about it. He had no idea. He's an adult, by the way, at this point, so he's not a child where someone else is leading. He's acting as king. And he's like, he never heard the Bible before. And he hears the judgment of God, and the prophetess says, yep, it's going to happen. Okay, verse 17, because they have forsaken me and have burned incense unto other gods that they might provoke me to anger with all the works of their hands. Therefore, my wrath shall be kindled against this place and shall not be quenched. In other words, it's too late. It's going to happen. But, she says to the king of Judah, verse 18, this is what she said, told the messenger to say to Josiah, because your heart was tender and thou hast humbled thyself before the Lord, when thou heardest what I spake against this place and against the inhabitants thereof, that they should become a desolation and a curse, and hast rent your clothes, tore your clothes, and wept before me, I also have heard you, says the Lord. Behold, therefore, I will gather you unto your fathers. Now, that's just a way of saying you're going to die at some point. I mean, all of us are going to die at some point. So at the point when you die and are gathered to your fathers, buried in, you know, this near where your ancestors are buried, and thou shalt be gathered into thy grave in peace, and thine eyes shall not see all the evil which I will bring upon this place. And they brought the king word again. Now, gathering together in peace doesn't mean I obeyed me, so your rule time. We know the case because that's not what at Megiddo in battle. What it means is he's going to die in peace in regards to these curses that God says are going to come upon Judah, where Judah's going to fall. It's not going to be in the lifetime of Josiah. He's not going to have to watch his nation go down. Now, it doesn't happen too long after that. But it's not going to happen in Josiah's lifetime. Now, in chapter 23, we read more about the reforms that take place. And let me see how I'm doing time-wise. I'm going to keep it moving along just to try to make sure I don't run into problems. But it says things like verse 4, he commands Hilkiah, the high priest, to take the vessels that are made for Baal and the grove, and he burned them outside of Jerusalem. Okay, he put down the idolatrous priests whom the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense in the high places. I mean, they had a full-on idolatry going on being conducted by the Levitical priests. And he's taken that all out, both the equipment and the locations, the groves, the vessels, and the people, and getting rid of them all. The groves in verse 6, the houses of sodomy in verse 7. And he brought all the priests out of the cities of Judah and defiled the high places where the priests had burned incense. And it talks about just a number of different gods that had been part of that. So, for example, I'm kind of skimming here to try to find this. I'm looking for one specifically. What was it? Let's see. I'm trying to think of the name of the king. Give me a moment. Okay, yeah, here it is. Verse 13, chapter 23, 13. It was Solomon. I couldn't remember which king it was. Solomon had set up a number of idolatrous worship sites. It said that he had built for the god Ashtaroth, the abomination of the Zidonians, and for the god Chemosh, the abomination of the Moabites, and the god Milcom, the abomination of the children of Ammon. Remember, he had all those wives that turned his heart from God and got Israel involved in idol worship. Some of those places still existed at the time of Josiah. Then King Jeroboam, the high places that he had built in the city of Bethel. Remember, he set up two places of idol worship in Israel with the golden calves to try to keep Israel from going back down to Jerusalem. Well, he destroyed, Bethel's in the southern kingdom, but he had set up some things down there. That was destroyed. And so he's going through a lot of reforms and getting rid of all this stuff. Okay, but then we come to the end of Josiah's life in verse 28. It says, now the rest of the acts of Josiah and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? Of course, we have that in the Bible. First and Second Chronicles are a second set of records of these things. And some of the events are the same, some of them differ. Like maybe give some additional information that the book of First and Second Kings doesn't give. Verse 29. In his days, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went up against the king of Assyria. So here you have this battle. We have the timelines again here. The bottom one is Egypt. And this third one up is Assyria. And there was this political, geopolitical struggle between those two countries happening all during this time period. So what happened? Okay. It says here, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went up against the king of Assyria to the river Euphrates, and King Josiah went up against him. So Josiah, at this time, was on the side of Assyria, fighting King Pharaoh Necho in Egypt. And it says, and King Josiah went up against him, and he, Pharaoh Necho, slew him, Josiah, at Megiddo, when he had seen him. Okay, so in other words, they have a battle there, and King Josiah died in battle. Okay, verse 30, and his servants carried him in a chariot dead from Megiddo and brought him to Jerusalem and buried him in his own sepulcher. And the people of the land took Jehoaz, the son of Josiah, and anointed him and made him king in his father's stead. Okay, so now we're going to go to our next slide, and we read about Jehoaz, or something like that. Don't cite me as a source for correct pronunciation on all these names. Well, you can. Feel free. I mean, right, isn't that what we do in our society? We cite sources of people who don't know what they're talking about. And we look them up on the internet. So you cite me as a source, you might be citing a source who doesn't know what he's talking about on pronunciation. So I didn't look up the pronunciation, so I'm just taking my best guess on these. All right. Well, now we're on Jehoahaz. This is his son. And, okay, so we see our points on the slide here. He was appointed by Jews to succeed Josiah, and he was rejected by Pharaoh Necho II. So they just lost the battle. Well, Pharaoh Necho II doesn't approve of this new king. We read about that in 2 Kings 23, verse 31. Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. And then in verse 32, he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. That's going to be the characteristic of all the rest of the kings. Verse 33, and Pharaoh Necho put him in bands, so he arrests him, and that he might not reign in Jerusalem, and put the land to a tribute of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. And Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in the room of Josiah. Now, in the room means in his place. So he took Josiah's place. Necho rejected Jehoahaz as king. And it says that he took Jehoahaz away and he came to Egypt and died there. So Jehoahaz was taken prisoner down to Egypt and he died in Egypt. Okay. So Jehoiakim gave the silver and gold to Pharaoh, their pay and tribute, and that's the end of Jehoahaz. Okay. So now we come to our next slide. So we're going to go to Jehoiakim, and we can see some of the points here. He's another son of Josiah, appointed by Necho, and his loyalty shift back and forth between Egypt and Babylon, because by this time Assyria is gone, Babylon's on the scene, taking a serious place. Now there's a geopolitical battle between Babylon and Egypt. The Battle of Carchemish is a victory that Babylon has over Egypt. So at that point, Egypt ceases to be much of an influence in this region for about 20 or 30 years, and then they kind of briefly rise up again, but they don't really get established quite so strong. And then he's possibly assassinated, says there. So we read about that in 2 Kings 23, beginning in verse 36. He's 25 years old. He begins to reign. He does evil, verse 37. We go to chapter 24, verse 1. In his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant 3 years. So he submits to him. And then he turned and rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. And the Lord sent against him bands of the Chaldeans and Moabites, Syrians, and so forth. So God sends in trouble for him and basically punishes Jehoiakim, and he is taken out. Okay? And so then Jehoiakim sleeps with his fathers, chapter 24, verse 6. And the king of Egypt came not again any more out of his land, for the king of Babylon had taken from the river of Egypt unto the river of Euphrates all that pertained to the king of Egypt. In other words, Egypt lost the battle of Carchemish, and Egypt can't really go out of Egypt anymore because they don't have any power to do so. Okay, so then the next ruler is Jehoiakim. Okay, first point there, son of Jehoiakim. And he doesn't reign very long, reigns 3 months, throws himself at the mercy of Babylon, and he's going to be deported along with 10,000. We read about that in chapter 24, verse 10. At that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came against Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. Chapter 24, verse 11. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came against the city. Verse 12, Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother's servants, princes, etc. And the king of Babylon took him in the 8th year of his reign and carried out thence all the treasures of the house of the Lord, the treasures of the king's house. They broke up a bunch of the other pieces and it took some of the metals and things. He carried, verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar carried away all Jerusalem, all the princes, so it means the political leadership, means a lot of the talented, educated people, all the mighty men of valor, so the men of war, even 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and smith, all the talented workers, they're all carried off. Why? He's going to put their talents to work for him now. And so none remained, verse 14, save or except the poorest sort of the people of the land, the less educated people, the less skilled. So in other words, Israel loses a lot of its talent and skills, right? I mean, we benefit by people who have talent and skills. Do you have a cell phone on you? You know, a watch? Yeah, do you know how to make that? Okay, me neither. If the people who know how to make that are gone, we don't have those anymore. Well, of course, they didn't have cell phones back then, but they lost the ability to benefit from a lot of the things from these skilled craftsmen, political leaders, and even protect themselves from the mighty men of war. The weak people are left, the ones less skilled, less talented. And so, now that, by the way, is in the year 7, which I haven't emphasized yet, but there Babylon does three waves of deportations. I didn't emphasize on 605. That's the there's a wave of deportation that takes place there when, and I'll just go back to the previous slide, when Jehoiakim is king, and they're forced to submit in 605. This is the time period when Daniel's carried off into captivity. Okay, but then they set up, and back to our slide here, Jehoiakim, when he decides and Israel decides to try to rebel against them, that rebellion's put down, and then you get a second round of deportations. Jehoiakim himself is carried off into captivity as well, along with the others. And so then in chapter 24, verse 17, the king of Babylon made Mattaniah, his father's brother, king in his stead, and changed his name to Zedekiah. So now we'll go to our last king here, King Zedekiah. So when we're looking at our Judah timeline at the top, Zedekiah was the son of Josiah. Jehoiakim's father, Jehoiakim, was also the son of Josiah. So Zedekiah's name was Mattaniah. He's the brother of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah. So now what Nebuchadnezzar's doing is he's setting up puppet kings, kings that in some way are saying, we'll be loyal to you, and we'll help rule our people and make sure they're all in line and they do what you say. That's what Mattaniah or Zedekiah basically agrees to. Now, he doesn't follow through on that. And so if we look at our kind of our points here, so he's the son of Josiah, appointed by Nebuchadnezzar, but Judah still considers rebelling. Okay? During this time period, Egypt reemerges. There's a battle. They're defeated. Israel, in this, tries to rebel, and in some senses, you might say they join on Egypt's side or see an opportunity anyways. They're also defeated along with Egypt. And so Jerusalem is besieged. It falls. I think Egypt was defeated first, and then after that, he took care of Jerusalem. Then Zedekiah is blinded and deported. And that's the beginning of the 7 years of a captivity. So I'll read a little bit about this from the Bible on this. 2 Kings chapter 25, verse 1. It came to pass in the ninth year of his reign, Zedekiah's reign, in the tenth month, in the tenth day, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and all his host, against Jerusalem, and pitched against it, and they built forts. The city was besieged, verse 2. Verse 3, a famine ensued because the city's besieged. So they start to have famine within the city. Then verse 4, the city was broken up. The men of war fled the city. The Chaldean army pursues. After the king, so the king would have been amongst the men of war trying to flee the city. They catch up to him. They took the king, verse 6, and brought him up to the king of Babylon. In verse 7, they killed all of Zedekiah's sons in front of him so he could watch. And then they jabbed his eyes out. So basically, this is major punishment. By the way, this sends fear to other kings that would dare to rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. And that's a big reason why they do these types of things. Sending a warning to all those that were under Babylonian submission. Don't you dare rebel like Judah, because here's what's going to happen to you. The king is forced to watch all his children die, and then his eyes gouged out, so that basically that's the last thing you get to see in life. They poke his eyes out, they bind him in fetters of brass, and carry him off to Babylon. And so he lives the rest of his life in captivity in Babylon. And I don't think we know much what that would have been like. Is that in a prison, a dungeon, or is he in house arrest? Who knows? But he's off the political scene. They burnt the house of the Lord, verse 9, and basically destroy a lot of Jerusalem. And this then is the final captivity in 586. And again, him along with others are deported to Babylon during this time period. Okay. And so then I already read that. I've got, for whatever reason, I've got duplicate verses here. Printed off the same set of verses twice. How interesting. Okay. And then it says in verse 12, but the captain of the guard of the Babylonians left the poor of the land to be wine dressers and husbandmen. In other words, they were left behind, and they're going to be expected to work, and that's going to bring tribute to Babylon, and Babylon's going to benefit from that. And that's going to be kind of the condition you find Judah and Israel in later, after 70 years. And by the way, why 70? They had not honored the God in the Sabbath years of rest that they were supposed to give the land. So in the Old Testament law, you would farm the land, which is almost like letting land go fallow. There's benefits to that, not over-farming land. But God had set it up every seventh year, you're going to give the land some rest. Well, the people didn't want to do that because they were greedy. They wanted to profit. They could have done that. They could have saved up in the 6 years and been okay. But their greed led them to disregard the word of the Lord and his instructions, and they never did it. So God said, well, you never did it. I'm going to still get it. 490 years of not doing that 1 year every 7 years, I want them all back. Out of 490, that's 70 groups of seven. Seven times 70, 490. God took back 70 years of Sabbath years. The land had rest as a punishment. And so that's where the Lord left that. Okay, well, today and what was going on in Israel during this time, like I said, we didn't spend a lot of time on application, but there's all kinds of application because the same God that dealt with those things then, he deals with us now. And one of the points, you can't sin and get away with it. But another little side one, Josiah was blessed by God even in the midst of a lot of difficult times. So we can't always control what's going on in society and things going on, but we can still honor the Lord and be personally blessed. And Josiah was personally blessed that he didn't have to live to see how bad it was going to get. And him personally, you know, he didn't have to experience what Zedekiah did. He personally wasn't going to have his eyes gouged out and watch all his children getting killed. And, you know, so there was some mercy on him. But his act alone could not turn God's wrath from the nation which had dishonored him. And so one king alone, that wasn't enough for God to say, I'm going to take back the punishments that I had planned on. But you never know. As David said when his son was going to die because of David's sin with Bathsheba, he fasted. He said, you know, I didn't know, but the Lord might change his mind. So you never know. In David's case, the Lord didn't change his mind and the baby died. And in Josiah's case, he didn't change his mind. But the Lord can do that. And so you never know. We could be imperfect.